Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Andy, Don, and Dude.
I'll have a hot cup of albums with some humor on the side. It's the Album Nerds Podcast. I'm Dude. I got Andy and Don with me. You guys ready to talk about some side hustles?
Yeah, you know it, man. Got my coleslaw and my hash browns here, mashed potatoes, side of maybe it's corn chowder.
That's a lot of sides. What are you at Boston Market?
Yeah, exactly. How are you doing over there, Don?
Good, but I got to hurry up because I've got to record an episode of the Donnie Likey podcast.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Your little side hustle?
Unfortunately, nobody else likeys.
Dude is so bitter.
You're nothing without us, man. So this is the Album Nerds Podcast. We love albums and the album format and each other, if we're being honest. We got a great show for you today. We're each going to be bringing to the table an album that was recorded on the side, like a side project. Don's going to be asking us the deepest of questions. Then we'll have some shout outs to some other albums and album related items we're digging. And of course, we're going to spin the wheel of musical discovery to find out what we'll talk about on the next episode. This week, it's all about those side projects.
That's what I'm talking about!
Side projects allow artists to explore creative avenues outside their primary bands or careers, often resulting in albums that showcase unique styles or unexpected collaborations. These ventures have produced some of the most memorable records in music history, blending genres and pushing boundaries in ways that redefine artistic expression.
Ooh la la.
And some not so much.
But yeah.
Today, each of us will present an album from an artist's side project.
So I found this more challenging than I thought because there are a lot out there, but you know, we were trying to keep it in mind that this was not a replacement. This was not someone quitting a band and starting a new band, but that it was things that they did and then went back to their respective bands. So what albums did you guys find that fit the bill but weren't perfect? Not your final picks, but something else you considered.
Yeah, the one I almost went with was from The Breeders. They were popular in the early 90s there. Their mm-hmm. debut album, Pod, came out in 1990. This was a spinoff project for Kim Deal of the Pixies and Tanya Donnelly from Throwing Muses.
What's the deal with The Breeders? I apologize.
That's good.
Yeah, I was a pretty big fan of them back in the day. I think more so their follow-up album after this, which was Splashdown. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, with that song Cannonball. Yeah,
Last Splash was actually the name.
Oh yeah, Last Splash.
Yeah, good stuff. Good alternative rock. Kind of underrated, in my opinion.
But at that point of Last Splash, and that's when they almost sort of just became The Breeders, and then the previous stuff stopped mattering so much. You know.
Yeah, the Pixies were done by then.
That happens. What did you find in your journey, Stan?
Well, this shouldn't surprise anybody, but I kind of went to the world of New Order and the Smiths. Mm-hmm. So in 1991, Bernard Sumner from New Order collaborated with Johnny Marr, you know, formerly of the Smiths, and he was kind of moonlighting with everybody at the time, the Brian Ferry. But anyway, a project called Electronic, which it was kind of a blend of sort of that electronic dance music of New Order with some,
I should hope so,
with some guitar thrown on top of it. Yeah, it's the name all kind acoustic, of suggests that. Yeah.
Why did they call it electronic guitar?
Electronic guitar. What are you talking about?
Sorry, Don. But it's actually, I mean, it's a solid album. It actually features Neil Tennant from the Pet Shop Boys on a couple of tracks. So wow. Definitely a good piece of 1990s.
It's like you were the producer for that album or something. Don't
yeah.
Yeah,
no. Yeah. But it's not quite as good as you would think. You know, sometimes when you have two people you admire, sometimes, you know, when they get together, it's not all that amazing.
Oil and water.
Mm. Dude.
So one project that I thought was interesting was SOD. The Stormtroopers of Death and their 1985 album Speak English or Die.
Jeez.
A crossover thrash band. It's thrash and punk, formed by Anthrax member Scott Ian on guitar, Charlie Benante on drums, with bassist Dan Liker from Nuclear Assault and vocalist Billy Milano.
Donnie Liker.
Danny Liker in this case. But It was originally started as like a tongue-in-cheek project during some downtime from Anthrax's recording schedule. It's raw and aggressive, unfiltered, and it helped pioneer the hardcore punk thrash metal kind of blend. But it's kind of offensive in many ways, and they say it's to, you know, have fun and push boundaries, and it was all tongue-in-cheek as in this, you know, Stormtroopers of Death characters, but... If you don't have all that context, just listening to it, you could get a little ickied out by some of the lyrics. So that's the main reason that I didn't really want to get too deep into it. But it's an interesting side project that I explored this week. All right. So enough about what we didn't pick. Let's get to our real choices.
You choose me?
All right, for my side project selection, we're talking about Hot Tuna and their 1972 album, Burgers.
That feels more like the main entree, not the side.
That's true. This is the third album, first studio album for the Jefferson Airplane offshoot. It's primarily comprised of Airplane members Joma Kekkonen and Jack Cassidy. Well, Grace Slick, the vocalist for the Airplane, was recovering from vocal cord surgery. This guy's kind of did some live albums, some live shows, toured a little bit, and then settled down and put out this album in 72.
Okay, so that's how it's their third album, but their first studio. Got it.
Right, got a couple of live things. Albums. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. So they kind of honed their sound on the road, but put out this record here. Let's jump in and play track two. This is called Highway Song.
I think Kraftwerk Autobahn was a response to this.
Pretty sure. It's kind of like a folksy, bluesy song there about longing for the road, getting out on the road, written by Kekkonen there. Most of the tracks are written by Jorma, though there are a few covers. I was really surprised by this. I didn't really know what to expect and heard of the group before. I was hoping for something in that Airplane sound. It's not quite that, but I thought it was pretty enjoyable. My clickbait headline for Burgers is, "Don't worry that your flight is canceled. Hot Tuna is grilling up something real nice."
Yeah, just Hot Tuna.
Just can't get over that thought of that, can you?
No. I mean, it's just yucky sounding. Like, I still think they would have been better off being tuna melt, but, you know.
Yeah, well. Tuna tartar.
Be a little too highbrow here, maybe.
Yeah.
So this is an interesting collection of, like, folk Americana and blues songs. I think these two guys, the guitarist and the bassist from the Airplane, very underrated, man. They sound great, and they play together very, very well. Just kind of goes to show, like, how talented some of these musicians were coming out of that San Francisco scene in this, you know, late 60s, early 70s period.
And they're not even the names I know from Airplane. Like, I know Paul Kantner and who's the other, Marty Bolin or whatever, you know, so, like,
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're not even like the popular, popular celebrities from the group.
Ouch!
But I think it just speaks to the quality of the musicianship. It was really high in that group, and these guys, you know, can totally handle it on their own. They are joined here by violinist Papa John Creech, who was in at the Airplane at the time as well, and kind of bounced around from different groups during this period.
Actually, I have one of his albums.
Do you? From the 70s?
Yeah, it's called Playing My Fiddle for You from 1974. Mm-hmm. I picked it up because I just the cover looked interesting and he had a cool name. And I looked him up and I was like, oh, Airplane. And it's a good record.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
He's a welcome addition to the group here. I think he sounds great on the tracks. They feature him here. Let's play one of those cuts here that has more of a folk quality to it. This is the most popular song on the album. It's called Water Song.
So Water Song is an instrumental composed by Kekkonen. Water Song is an instrumental composed by
just say his first Jorma. Name. Right.
Composed by Jorna K.
You just don't want to say. He just can't say
it. I'm not going
to
even say it.
It's fine.
I'm not going to even say
it's fine.
All right, so
by the lead guitar.
By the Coco Man.
Yeah, Coco Man.
That's your nickname for him.
All right, so Water Song is an instrumental composed by the Coco Man. It's Kekkonen. Anyway, so you've got Sammy Piazza on drums, I think, on most of these tracks. It's an interesting tune. So he's like finger picking, and I think that's supposed to kind of simulate the water movement. Mm-hmm. And then you've got Cassidy playing, playing kind of melodic bass lines. And I guess, you know, why it appeals to me is because it sort of has that new wave thing where the bass actually provides the melody and the guitar is sort of more of that, you know, supporting role. It's in open G tuning. You ever try doing your guitar to open G?
No.
I guess it's D, G, D, G, B, D, which I guess has some effect like this. I guess I'm always afraid to mess with my tunings because I'm going to break strings.
Yeah. Yeah, my guitar is so out of tune all the time. Trying to put it in a different one would just be a nightmare.
All right. Well, my clickbait headline for burgers is Papa John Creech, I'm in trouble deep. Sorry.
Okay. Have you made up your mind?
I'm keeping my baby. Sorry, that was just a stupid excuse to make that joke. But anyway, so that's, you know, just a shout out to the violinist who you guys already mentioned. I really like that final instrumental track, Sunny Day Strut. Mm-hmm. It features the violin a lot there. Yeah, I mean, this was a nice find. I had heard of Hot Tuna, but never really listened to it. I guess it appeals to me in the way that those like Americana Grateful Dead records do. You know, it's not quite as it doesn't have quite as much of a country feel, maybe a little more blues. But yeah, I mean, it's nice. The musicianship is great, and there's a good balance, you know. So I mean, there are arrangements, you know, it's like precise arrangements, but there's also some instrumental exploration, but they don't go too far, you know. I mean, they don't devolve into, you know, long jam sessions, which is how I picture their live work being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most songs stay under, you know, 4 or 5 minute area, but I think there's like there's composed passages, but there's moments where they do feel like they jam out, especially the violin. I think does kind of add some of that soloing aspect to the album that we could feel a little bit more lively than just a paint by number kind of situation.
Yeah. There's just real chemistry, I think, between Kekkonen and Cassidy, you know.
Yeah, they're great together. They seem to be the principal members of the group here. It's come together and disbanded many times over the decades, and there's a current iteration of it even going today, which I was impressed to read.
They keep on trucking.
That's right.
Perfect segue for our next track here. This is Keep On Trucking.
Yeah, so Keep On Trucking is based on a classic early 20th century blues by the work of Blind Boy Fuller. And Fuller popularized the phrase Keep On Trucking, apparently. Hot Tuna's version is laid back. It's a good time jam. It's built around that rolling groove that I think kind of adds to that keep on trucking, you know, moving along the road sort of sound. Lyrics are simple. There's mentions of hot fish and stuff in it. I'm unclear on what the obsession with hot fish is, but, you know, I'm not here to judge, man. Whatever makes you happy.
Well, supposedly this song here, and one of the lyrics from it was the origin of the band's name.
Ah.
Someone had shouted out that smells like hot tuna or something like that during the performance. So here we are.
Excellent. So my clickbait headline, I was going to go for a whole thing with they built this album, you know, on hot tuna instead of rock and roll. But, you know, in having this conversation, I feel like it's something more appropriate for my clickbait headline is, hey, Hot Tuna, Jerry Garcia called. He wants his sound back. Now, it's not quite that. It's not quite that bad. They definitely have their own, it's probably a little more twangy than the Dead or Jerry Garcia band. But this is a band from San Francisco. It's the late 60s. I think these guys had an opportunity to roll around a little bit more in that sound and less in the psychedelic edges that they were playing in more with Jefferson Airplane. So yeah, it's refreshing. It sounds very natural. It doesn't sound like a ripoff, but it does sound like a part of that movement, like a legitimate part of that movement. And it was cool to listen to. Like Don, I'd heard of Hot Tuna. When I first heard the name, I assumed it was some kind of like punk band or something.
Yeah.
So to get the context and learn about it was nice. You know, this side project is one of those things that helps feed the creative needs sometimes of band members when their main thing is on the, you know, on the bench for a while because of a vocal injury. So yeah, it's fun. I liked it.
Yeah. Yeah. It feels like exactly what this was. They did end up opening for Airplane when the group got back together, and then, you know, obviously continued on under the Hot Tuna name for many, many decades. So yeah, if you're curious guys hearing what those guys from Jefferson Airplane were doing back in the 70s, I think their debut record is a great place to start. So check out Hot Tuna Burgers.
Before we continue our journey on the side, it's time to give a shout out to one of our podcast brethren, Polyphonic Press Classic Album Reviews.
Each week, Jeremy and John randomly select an album from a list of over 1,000 releases, and they listen to it. And actually, it's kind of cool the way they do it. You know, they have no preparation at all. They tell the listener to listen to it at the same time. At the end of side A, they start, you know, responding to it, and then they play side B and, you know, give their final thoughts on it. The latest episode features the Bob Marley and the Wailers album, Catch a Fire. Mm. They dig into, you know, how it shaped reggae as a genre. And before that, they did Elvis Presley's self-titled debut for RCA.
Mm, cool.
It's a cool approach. And definitely the album nerd in me sometimes wants to hear people get thrown off by something maybe they didn't expect or experience before. So, yeah, it's fun. So make sure and check out Polyphonic Press when you're not listening to us.
It could be your side piece. My pick for a side project comes from Arcadia, an album called So Red the Rose, released in November of 1985. So Arcadia is a side project of Duran Duran members Simon Laban, Nick Rhodes, and Roger Taylor. So basically at the peak of their success, the band kind of went on a hiatus and effectively like split in two. So guitarist Andy Taylor and bassist John Taylor formed the Power Station with vocalist Robert Palmer and Tony Thompson of Chic. It was kind of a fusion of hard rock and funk. Arcadia is a completely different direction, more artsy synth pop.
Yeah, a little glam rock too. Mm-hmm. If the band is splitting into two, why wasn't one band Duran and the other band Duran?
That would have been confusing.
That would have made for better, easier marketing though, right?
Are you Duran 1 or Duran 2? I would have gone with Taylor maybe would have made sense instead of Power Station, but nice. What else?
All right, well, let's hear the opening cut and first single from the album, Election Day.
I think the big confusion for me is if you hear Simon Laban's voice, you think it's Duran Duran, and then the Power Station guys, you wouldn't necessarily know it has anything to do with. No offense, it's just, you know.
Yeah, even beyond that, I mean, this is much more Duran than the Power Station was. So, Election Day is not political at all. So it uses the concept of Election Day as a metaphor for moments of reckoning and decision making and personal change. So it actually features a spoken word part by Grace Jones in the middle there. Yeah, I mean, that's typical of the album. There's a lot of special appearances by people, which we'll talk about. So instead of John Taylor on bass, you've got Mark Egan playing some fretless bass. And then on guitar, you've got Carlos Alomar, who's played with Bowie, and Masami Tsuchiya. And do you guys remember the Sax Appeal episode?
Of course.
We did a Roxy Music album featuring Andy McKay. And of course, he is on this album as well. So it's just an all-star cast. My clickbait headline for So Red the Rose is Nick Rhodes' wet dream. So Red the Rose is something you should know. So something you should know, like the song. Is there something I should know?
I'm making an eerie face. No one can see it, but...
Okay. So, you know, the way I look at Duran Duran, you've got like three major creative forces. You've got Nick Rhodes, who's kind of this artsy fartsy stuff. You've got Andy Taylor, who's kind of the rock guitarist. And you've got John Taylor, who's kind of the funk bass guitarist. And so this is what happens when Nick Rhodes, you know, gets his say. So I think this is very much a Nick Rhodes album. I like it. I'm not sure exactly where it ranks among like Duran Duran albums, but you know, it definitely, you know, provides some context, you know, fills in the blanks between their third album, and Notorious. It's good. let's hear another track. This is Goodbye Is Forever.
So that was the second single from the album. It sounds like Duran Duran of this era to me. Like, if you played this for me, I don't think I would know the difference, because I'm not a devoted fan. Mm-hmm. I mean, I enjoy it. I enjoy Duran Duran's albums, but I wouldn't really know that this isn't one of their records.
Really? You don't miss the little jammy, funky bounciness of the bass? Yeah.
There's a little bit on that track there, but
yeah, I'm not sure I would notice. I would just think that they were changing directions a little bit. I wouldn't think it was a different band. You know, there's the lush synths, more intricate bass lines that are kind of the stitching of the song rather than driving things. But lyrically, it deals with the inevitability of change and bittersweet nature of parting ways, impermanence, emotional resilience, and maybe the separation that they're talking about here isn't just about romance. Maybe it has something to do with the dynamics of the band, and are they gonna get together again? Is this the new path? Who knows? But the whole album does have this mid-80s Bowie-esque sound to me. And I think it kind of fed what Duran Duran sounded like after this, as Don kind of alluded to. My clickbait headline to describe the album: So the Red Rose, if David Bowie and Brian Ferry had a love child and Duran Duran raised it.
Be a handsome child.
Yes. Very talented.
Yes. Great head of hair.
I mean, I'm feeling all those vibes, and a lot of the things you mentioned, Don, the players on this are artists who worked with those artists, Bowie and Brian Ferry. So I think what I was hearing, I think my instincts were correct. Just want to make that clear.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, there's no denying that, you know, Bowie and Roxy Music were huge influences on Duran Duran. All right, well, let's hear another cut. This is the all-star track, or features an all-star lineup here. This is The Promise.
Why didn't he just say, I want my MTV, really? Drive the point home.
It's the third single off the album there. It's featuring Sting on backing vocals, of course. Pretty nice get. Apparently the group saw them in concert and asked him to be on the album, and he agreed.
Yeah, that track also has David Gilmour on guitar and Herbie Hancock on keyboards.
Wow. Embarrassment of riches.
That was an expensive track to produce.
The album was recorded in Paris, and so I think when these artists were on tour and they stopped in Paris, you know, apparently they ended up in the studio with a lot of cocaine.
Great.
All right, my clickbait headline for So Red the Rose is Arcadia asked the question, is one Duran enough? So Red the Rose answered back, maybe, but not for very long. I think this is a pretty solid collection of, you know, as Don said, kind of like artsy synth pop, sophistipop, if you will.
Yes.
But it does feel to me like something is missing. I mean, I'm not a huge Duran Duran fan, but I have a mental image of what they sound like, and this is not quite it. It does feel like there's just an ingredient or two not quite in the stew here. I think it's most evident on like that track, Goodbye Is Forever, where there is like a more of a focus on the bass and the rhythm, but it's just not nearly as impactful as I think it would have been if that was a Duran Duran song, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I think there's a few moments on here that made me think, oh, I wonder what this would have been like if it was like Rio or something. The only song that really felt like it could have been a Duran Duran song was El Diablo, the second to last cut. Mm. But that was just my take as a kind of an outsider looking in on this. But, you know, all in all, I thought it was pretty enjoyable, but maybe not quite up to the standards that I expected from these guys.
Yeah, and this is around the time where the star was, you know, about to fade or starting to fade. And I guess it's debatable whether, like, creatively, you know, they faded, but, you know, they were sort of losing their place on the top of the charts.
I wonder if they had any kind of agreement, like a gentleman's agreement or a bet about whichever album did better, that sound would then be what they lean toward for the next Duran Duran, because this one went platinum at least, right? And I don't think the Power Station did quite as well.
No, actually, I think Power Station at least in terms of chart performance, was much more successful. Really? But they both were, I mean, they both did well enough, you know. If you ask people, I think more people probably recognize the Power Station than this.
I think so. I couldn't name
it. Like, Some Like It Hot is, you know, I mean, I feel like that song kind of lives on.
Huh?
Really? You don't, like, I think people think it's a Robert Palmer song.
Oh, the Heat Is On thing?
No,
yeah,
no, I just not the heat. Well, the, yeah, Some Like It Hot.
But he says
some like it hot and some sweat. Oh yeah, feel the heat. Yeah,
yeah. I just thought that was a Robert Palmer song.
Yeah,
so, swinging and missing. Well, that's what I was saying. You kind of need, like, having Simon is what.
Yeah, it's
yeah, the, makes it
the vocal signature of the yeah, group. You know. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the next Duran Duran album, Notorious, kind of is a blend between these two things. You know, it sounds a bit like this, but it also has a little more, you know, kind of Chic inspired funk.
So was it when they were apart, was it understood that they were going to get back together, or was there kind of some tension between these groups?
Oh, there was definitely tension between them, but I think the expectation was they would return. And they did get back together, but Andy Taylor ended up leaving the group early on, you know, during the recording of the next album.
Yeah, I mean, the two hunks of the band, John Taylor and Simon Le Bon, maybe they just needed to stop being in competition all the time for a little while.
Maybe.
Who's on more Teen Beat covers?
So only so much hairspray to go around, you know, guys. Yep.
All right. Well, Arcadia is one of the successful side projects where artists pursue creative urges that were held back by their main acts. It does not outshine the best Duran Duran moments, but it is an essential addendum to their discography.
Ooh. Addendum.
Addendum.
Excuse me. I'd like to ask you a few questions.
It's time again for Deep Questions by Don. So these, you know, this discussion of musical side projects kind of reminded me of, you know, television characters who kind of spin off, you know, to new shows. What are some notable TV spinoffs?
Well, not the hugest TV head in history, so I went to my favorite resource, Wikipedia, and they have a massive list of TV spinoffs. And I was blown away by some of them and how many there are.
Right.
Star Trek, over 8 spinoffs, and that was just for the original show. But by far the most I could find was from Scooby-Doo, over 16 spinoffs from the original cartoon.
Yeah, amazing. They kept reworking that character. I mean, they should have just done more spinoffs of Scrappy-Doo. He was the best.
There's Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? Scooby-Doo.
Yeah.
Scooby-Doo movies or whatever, I think it was. One of them had the guest stars, like they had Batman and Robin on, right, and Sonny and Cher.
Globetrotters.
Don Knotts.
Rod.
Don Knotts, yeah.
Those were my favorite ones when I was a kid.
Yeah, Don Knotts one is great.
Phyllis Diller.
Oh, yeah.
Mama Cass.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it was weird.
There were a lot of good big stars on that show. But how about you, dude?
Well, I dug around a little bit for some more obscure, weird ones. I mean, there's big ones like, you know, or memorable ones like Joey had a spinoff from Friends and Frasier a spinoff from Cheers. But some of the ones I read about was The Art of Being Nick. Now, for anyone that remembers or watched Family Ties, Nick played Mallory's boyfriend, and he was just like artist that made art from garbage, and he kind of had a little catchphrase, Mallory, Alex, you know, he was this different kind of guy. They did a spinoff, The Art of Being Nick, and they tried like a few different stories, but they ended up doing one pilot, but then it did pretty well. But apparently the network got a little scared that stripping him out of Family Ties would be bad for that show, so they backed off.
Couldn't be in two shows, huh?
I don't quite understand why they couldn't have worked that out. But yeah, he was like a big pop cultural splash for a couple of months. Wendy's commercials, it's like, hey, it's Nick.
My Demon Lover, I think, was a film.
I happened to watch that last year for Valentine's Day. Yeah, that's really the same guy.
That sounds romantic.
I think so. I could be mistaken.
But. He gets horny and turns into a demon. It's funny.
Yeah, that's him.
Well, then that's definitely the spinoff to watch. My Demon Lover.
Yeah, it's interesting how, you know, you never know if a character is like strong enough to carry a show. So you mentioned Frasier, you know, from Cheers. I remember when Cheers ended and it was a big deal. And then, you know, finding out that there was going to be a Frasier spinoff. And I was like, I mean, he wasn't like,
yeah.
I don't know. You know, he wasn't Norm choice, and he wasn't, you know. So I was like, oh, is that good material for a sitcom? And it really was. I mean, I think Frasier is, you know, one of the great sitcoms of all time. It's just so witty and so well done. Unlike another spinoff, the first spinoff of Cheers was called The Tortellis. So it featured the character Nick Tortelli, who's Carla's ex-husband, who married, you know, the blonde trophy wife. Kind of rewatching Cheers, I actually really enjoy his character.
Yeah, he's such a slimeball.
Yeah, it's really funny, but they spun it off.
Yeah, he was, and it didn't work.
Yeah, it was not good.
It's an odd choice.
All right. Well, what's your favorite spinoff? Let us know on Instagram and Facebook or leave a comment on our website, albumnerds.com.
Much like Don, I went to the well of my favorite music from my younger years, the Seattle grunge scene. I went with Mad Season's album Above, the only studio album recorded by Mad Season, released March 14th, 1995 on Columbia Records. A supergroup of sorts formed by Mike McCready of Pearl Jam, Lane Staley of Alice in Chains, Barrett Martin of Screaming Trees, and John Baker Saunders of The Walkabouts.
JBS.
The band came together almost by accident after McCready and Saunders met in rehab. This was shortly after Vitalogy came out by Pearl Jam. So the band came together almost by accident after McCready and Saunders met in rehab and decided to continue their sobriety by focusing on music. They then invited in Barrett Martin, who also had recently come out of rehab, and then Lane Staley. So they played live a few times. They invited Lane Staley to be their vocalist, and they hoped really to help him, you know, get through his addiction issues. So Lane Staley was heavily influenced by Cahill Gibran's The Prophet. It's a book. While writing the lyrics for Above, I guess he carried a copy of it around with him. So why don't we jump into the opening track, Wake Up. So a haunting, slow-building, atmospheric song, kind of setting the tone for that emotional journey that facing your demons, your addictions. And that's not unfamiliar territory for Lane Staley. He talked about that a lot in the lyrics of Alice in Chains songs as well. But musically, a restrained, powerful arrangement, great bass line, sparse blues influence guitars, the little vibraphone type sounding pieces there, and that line slow suicides, no way to go is I think has stuck. I've heard that being used.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a powerful line.
Just warnings about addiction and waking up, a plea to others and himself to get past it. My clickbait headline to describe the album: supergroup, super sad, super brilliant. How Mad Season built Above from rehab and hope. Unfortunately, Lane and John Baker Saunders did not make it, but Lane was able to communicate a dark hope, and JBS added a bluesy bass groove that supported that hopeful sadness throughout the album. And yeah, the album artwork also is kind of sad. That was drawn by Lane Staley himself, skeletal portraits.
Very, very, you know, graphic, iconic look to it. I was appreciated the artwork on this record.
And overall, the album feels looser and more jam-oriented than either Alice in Chains or Pearl Jam's polished work would have dared to go. So why don't we take a journey on the River of Deceit? The river of deceit
pulls down. It's the first single off the record, and I think, at least for my money, the song that this group is known for. It was pretty popular on the radio when I was growing up.
I can picture a lot of flannel-wearing kids just kind of swaying their heads slowly.
Yeah, see, for me, it was just too sad. Like, I didn't like that song. I didn't want it to be dark. I mean, I want it to be dark, but, like, fun dark.
Fun dark.
Yeah, I mean, I would call this a pretty introspective record, and I think that song in particular is, as much as the lyrics are, but I think the guitar playing, too, is kind of, at least gets me into a more introspective headspace. My clickbait headline for Mad Season's Above is, "You mad, bro? Razbov with his introspective collection of Sophistic Grunge.
Sophistic Grunge. Nice. Ooh, I think that is fresh. Funky fresh.
It's like you're wearing like a shirt and tie, but you've got a flannel over it.
Yeah.
Or tied around your waist, like I would have done.
I think this is a pretty interesting project. I think there's some really interesting moments or some really high quality moments, but there's a lot of misses too, I think, on here. There's just a lot of extra stuff and could have easily been edited if it was, you know, more of a proper album from a proper band.
Ouch.
But you can't deny these guys have a lot of skill, and I think it does show up on tracks like We Wake Up and River Deceit. And I Don't Know Anything, I think, is a really cool track from the middle that kind of stands out. Is
yeah,
feeling more up-tempo and got some interesting ideas in there. But there's a lot of self-indulgent songs, like November Hotel, I think, is just...
Oh, I love that one.
Yeah. The instrumental?
Oh, yeah. That one really pumped me up. Yeah, really? I loved November. Yeah. I mean, just the guitar on it is fantastic, I think.
This was an opportunity for Mike McCready, although he was lead guitar in Pearl Jam, but he was the only guitarist on this for the most part. Mm-hmm. This was his musical creation. I think that was an opportunity for him to express himself, because he's not a singer, about sobriety and all that, so...
Yeah, no, I think it fits with the overall vibe of the record. I just feel like it was a little too self-indulgent, man. It's like 7-minute guitar track. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think there's a really good 35-minute album in here somewhere that they could probably put it down to, but whatever, it doesn't really matter. It's a side project. It was an interesting little tidbit from this era.
Well, I saw an interview where Mike McCready said that doing this project helped his confidence as a songwriter, and he got more involved in Pearl Jam writing songs for subsequent records after that. Cool. All right, so why don't we check out another one of the tracks? This one has an interesting sound, that's for sure. It's called Long Gone Day.
Oh, yeah.
That was unexpected when I first heard this album.
It really works, too. So that saxophone is performed by somebody named Skerrick. I think that's how you pronounce it. But he's actually a Seattle musician. He has solo work, and he's performed on a lot of artists' records. That song also features vocals from Mark Lanegan, also of the Screaming Trees. So he's providing kind of that deeper sound, right? And Lane Staley's over the top.
Yeah, sort of, you know, Lane spent a lot of time singing with Jerry, so I think it was fun to hear the two of these voices together.
Yeah, it really works. It's an interesting arrangement, kind of jazzy, not just because of the saxophone. I think the rhythm, too. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure where in the progressive rock canon I, you know, recognize it, but it does feel sort of like it has a progressive rock vibe. I guess maybe it's the drumming or something. I'm not sure. But the lyrics of Long Gone Day explore themes of memory and loss and, I guess, existential dislocation. I guess Lanegan ended up getting co-writing credit for the lyrics.
Yeah. So he's also on the song I'm Above. I guess Lane just asked Mike, hey, can Mark be on the album? And they're like, sure. So he came in and worked on it. On the special edition of this from a few years ago, some songs were recorded with Mark on lead vocals. Mm. So there was a little bit more stuff done. He had addiction issues as well. So it's like they're all trying to encourage each other to move forward, you know? Yeah, it's dark.
Yeah.
Drugs are dark. Yeah.
Yeah.
It kind of reminds me of Voodoo by Godsmack. Remember that song?
Oh, God. Yes, of course.
Oh, the drum sound.
Yeah. I'm not the one who's so far away.
Yeah. Anyway, my clickbait headline for Above is, they tried to make them go to rehab, but they said, no, 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 we'll create dark tunes instead.
Oh, my God.
That's an Amy Winehouse reference there.
Amy Winehouse.
Yes, no, no, no.
Very sensitive of you.
yeah, I actually kind of feel. I mean, well, I mean, they were in rehab, right? I mean, so they all worked. They did go to rehab, and unfortunately, it didn't work out for everybody, which is unfortunate. But you know, I guess it's a cool way to do therapy. I guess you know, I mean, to channel all that energy and restlessness and pain into music, and I really think it's effective. I enjoyed this a lot. I've gone back and learned to appreciate Alice in Chains, but I never really connected with them. Back in the day. And I feel like this probably, had I heard it at the time, I think this could have drawn me in a little more. I like sort of this softer version of Layne Staley. He's not quite as aggressive or crass. Right. And, you know, he really is a gifted vocalist. And I think it comes out here.
I better appreciate it now that I'm older. When it first came out, it came out around the same time that the other new project, Foo Fighters, was popping. And this was dark and not fun. And I appreciated it, but it wasn't among my favorites. And coming back and digging into it, I mean, I've listened to it many times over the years, but really digging into it this week, I learned to, the more grown up me understands the darkness here and the struggle here. And it's more emotional than it was to listen to.
Yeah. It feels like a very just organic experience. You know, there's nothing contrived about it. You know, there's just, four guys jamming and, somebody writing lyrics about pain. It really works.
Well, Above isn't just a side project. It's also a personal and beautiful document of struggle, reflection, and fleeting hope, capturing the raw chemistry of four musicians that were standing at a crossroads. So go check it out. It's an interesting listen.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
All right. Well, I hope you fellows had a good week with your side pieces.
That is incorrect.
I'm in trouble here, man. I don't know.
Well, what else are you digging?
Well, I got a couple of things here in my cargo pockets on either side of my legs.
Okay, I'm glad you explained where the pockets are.
Just want to make that clear. First one for me is from Chicago-based art rock band Facts, F-A-C-S. This is their fifth studio album. It's called Wish Defense. Let's play the title track. Yeah, it's very angular, art rock, heavy bass line, kind of focus on duality in the lyrics. The reason this record stood out to me was it was the last album engineered by Steve Albini before he passed away last year.
Interesting.
So he was involved with the first few cuts on this record, and then he passed and someone else helped finish it up. But interesting little document here, and I think it's a good record too from Fax. And last one for me is Mandrake Handshake. Love the name of the
nice
band.
Name.
They have an album out called Earth Size Worlds. It's the debut full length for the London Collective, self-proclaimed a flower kraut band.
Okay.
It just seems like kraut rock and like 60s psychedelic flower power kind of thing.
All right. Let's hear it.
Let's play.
Yeah, bring
Hypersonic
it.
Hypersonic Super Astrid.
Heard the flower, searching for the kraut.
There's a little kraut in the mix, I think. Pretty bouncy, but definitely some psychedelic and pop elements in there from Mandrake Handshake. What you been digging on, Don?
A band called Pulp, which you may have heard of. They're coming out with their eighth studio album, their first in 24 years. They were formed in Sheffield, England, in 1978. You know, they kind of came out of the post-punk scene and into alternative rock, but they actually, I think, kind of became best known during that Britpop period of the mid and late 90s. Well, so their new album is called More, comes out June 6th. Here's a song called Spike Island. Do you guys prefer no pulp or lots of pulp? I'm a pulp guy.
I like pulp, yeah.
I like chunks of orange in my juice.
Oh, wow. Chunky style.
Yes. All right. Another pick, Turnstiles. They're kind of a hardcore punk band, but, they're sort of known for, incorporating more melodic elements and experimental influences. They have a new album coming out June 6th called Never Enough. Here's the title track.
That a little more softcore than I was expecting.
I was, I'm looking forward to hearing the rest of the album because, it doesn't feel all that hardcore.
Yeah, it was more of a Cinemax sort of, or Skinemax, as they used to say.
What are you digging, dude?
So after all that darkness from Mad Season, I was drawn to the band The Darkness and their 8th studio album.
Are you okay, dude?
Dreams on Toast.
Getting a little worried.
And The Darkness, obviously known from the early 2000s. I believe in a thing called love, if you don't remember. So this one, you know, they're flamboyant, glam rock, theatrics, punchy riffs, tongue-in-cheek lyricism. Let's listen to a little bit of I Hate Myself.
Well, it's not depressing music.
It's not. Yep.
Wow.
They're still around. Justin Hawkins, check out Justin Hawkins Rides Again on YouTube. He's got a channel where he talks about a lot of other artists and goes through their songs and breaks them down and stuff. It's funny. And he's successfully managed recovery as well. So that's always good to see. And then the next one is I picked this up actually a month or two ago when we were doing our country crossover episode. The band is Alabama, and the album is Feels So Right from 1981. I'd kind of forgotten I had grabbed it. It's kind of groundbreaking country in terms of blending traditional country sounds with Southern rock and pop influences. Lots of harmonies, really slick soft rock production. Let's listen to a little bit of Love in the First Degree. Marked a turning point in modern country, paving the way for that polished, mainstream-friendly style that defined the decade, some of which we talked about on that episode. It's barely country, but it's fun to listen to. It's very 81.
All right, well, what are you digging? Let us know. Join us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Also on our website, albumnerds.com.
It will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
Well, it's about that time on the show, and I'm reminded of the great American president, founding father, and co-author of the American Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson.
Quite a CV he's got there.
Yeah, the guy was fairly important to our country. All right. He said, if you want something you've never had, you must be willing to do something you've never done. Mm. With that in mind, let's bring out my friend and yours, Wabot, to see what we'll be talking about on next week's episode.
...1988 was a dynamic year where genres collided and new scenes emerged. Next time, you will be diving into albums from that year, records that defined the late 80s, pushed boundaries, and captured the spirit of a changing musical landscape.
The year 1988. Oh, yes.
Oh, man.
There will be some wonderful finds recorded in 1988.
Some slick production.
Indeed.
Hopefully some really tinny, no-bottom metal is what I'll be looking for. Yeah. Right?
That was like our sweet spot, but the more you guys describe it, I'm a little concerned.
All right, well, what's your favorite album from 1988? What else are you listening to? Email us at podcast@albumnerds.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky at Album Nerds. And visit albumnerds.com to suggest topics for the show, peruse the Hall of Fame, and listen to all 287 episodes. And the best way to support the show is to share it. Please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app.
Thank you once again for joining us on the Album Nerds podcast. We'll see you in Sweet 88.
Thanks for listening, everybody. See ya.
When the truth is found to be lies.
That's not too bad. Yeah, I think you'd be better off doing the version from Cable Guy when Jim Carrey's character does it. But people, go check that out. It's quite disturbing and hilarious.
More disturbing and hilarious than that?
It's surprisingly, yes.
Wow.
But they're close.